Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 3rd of April, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, we've got Charles Mallett. Welcome to the programme, Charles.
Thank you, Mike.
And from Damascus, Vanessa Bealey. And Vanessa, Damascus is where we're going to start today.
Yeah, 2 days ago, a really shocking attack on central Damascus. We can play the video. It's only about 30 seconds while I'm talking. Bear in mind that this area, so Israel basically targeted the consulate section of the Iranian embassy compound. You can see the Iranian embassy there in that particular shot. But so not only was an attack effectively on Iranian territory inside Syria, it violates the Vienna Convention against attacks on diplomatic and embassy centers in sovereign territory. But this area, just moving on as well, this area, for people to understand, is a bit like Oxford Circus in London. Medzeh Highway is the main highway, really, through the center of Damascus. This was at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, so it was 2 hours before iftar, the breaking of the fast during Ramadan. So the place was packed with people doing last-minute shopping before they went home to prepare food. And personally, I have a friend of mine whose two sisters were crossing the road during the explosion. One is still in critical care, as far as I understand, in hospital. So a number of civilians were killed in the attack. Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, who is probably the highest level IRGC Quds Forces commander killed since the assassination under the Trump administration of Qasem Soleimani back in 2021. But there were also in total seven IRGC military personnel assassinated in the attack. And the actual building that was completely destroyed is the residency. It doubles up as the residency for the ambassador. The general apparently was serving as a government official at the time of his assassination. So effectively, this renders it a terrorist act by Israel. We then move on to the response from the world community. The non-aligned axis has condemned the attack as a terrorist attack generally. The US scrambles to contain fallout from Israel's strike on Iranians and the aid workers will come on to later. But what they actually say inside the Time article is quite interesting. There's one expert, so he basically says, in the same way that we hold Iran accountable for the actions of its proxies, aka allies, providing arms and financial support to its allies in the region, they, Iran, hold the US responsible for Israeli actions because the US arms and finances the Israeli military. So quite an interesting admission in this article. Iran summoned the Swiss ambassador for a midnight meeting on Tuesday, asking them to pass on a message to Washington that the US must answer. Again, this comes on the heels, of course, of the Crocus concert terrorist attack in Moscow, where Russia is also effectively holding the US responsible. The US response has been ambivalent, to say the least. John Kirby, national security spokesman, dismissed as nonsense the Iranian charges of US responsibility for Monday's bombing. And he warned that Washington would respond to any retaliatory attacks. Of course, if it is deemed a terrorist attack, which by all accounts it is, then Iran has the right to respond. Instead, of course, what is the US doing in the pipeline for Israel? 50 new F-15 jets, which amount to about $18 billion. Of supply in themselves, medium-range air-to-air missiles, joint direct and attack munition kits, which are to convert dumb bombs, so-called dumb bombs, into precision missiles, as I said, in the pipeline for Israel that is also still conducting its genocidal campaign in Palestine. Russia called an emergency meeting at the UN Security Council after the attack. during which Nabensia basically said, have we got that slide, Mike?
No, we've got the White House video clip first, if you want.
Oh, I'm so sorry. That's my fault. So basically, very quickly, we have Matthew Miller as the United States spokesperson mentioning the fact that, of course, Israel is only defending itself as usual, and that's why they're supplying all of these weapons. So let's just roll that one quickly.
A 2,000-pound bomb is self-defensive.
They need to have the ability to defend themselves against a very well-armed adversary, like I said, Iran.
Again, the framing that this is all self-defense by Israel or preemptive self-defense by Israel attacking an Iranian embassy on Syrian territory, which, of course, comes in the midst of multiple other attacks by Israel, which I'll come on to in a minute. So at the UN Security Council, Russia's UN envoy told the Security Council briefing, we consider any attacks on diplomatic and consular premises, the inviolability of which is guaranteed by the relevant Vienna Conventions of 1961 and 1963, to be categorically unacceptable. This is not the first attack carried out by Israel in densely populated areas of Damascus, which generated high risk of mass casualties of civilians. Such aggressive actions by Israel are designed to further fuel the conflict. They're absolutely unacceptable and must stop. We urge West Jerusalem to abandon the practice of provocative acts against Syria and other areas. China also roundly condemned the attack. President Raisi in Tehran, the Zionists must know that they will never achieve their sinister goals with such inhumane actions. And day after day, we will witness the strengthening of the front of resistance, disgust, and hatred of the people towards the illegal nature of Israel. General consensus is that Iran is not going to hastily respond, but that it will respond in kind. That could, in my opinion, mean attacks, particularly on the Golan-occupied territories, and potentially against an Israeli embassy somewhere in the world. Now, I mentioned that it came in conjunction with other Israeli attacks, and in fact, 2 days before this attack on the Iranian embassy, Israel actually violated Syrian airspace. It entered through Jordan over the illegal American military base at Al-Tanf on the border with Jordan, entered at low altitude the Syrian Badia, the central desert area, to avoid radar detection, and fired missiles at eastern and west Aleppo in the north of Syria, at the same time as Al-Qaeda terrorists began a concerted attack on western Aleppo with drones and terrorist forces that was finally repelled. But this was a clear collaboration between Israel and Al-Qaeda, and that is definitely what we're seeing at the moment. Every time there is an Israeli attack, we're seeing an escalation in terrorist activity on all the fronts.
Vanessa, there's been quite a... At least there have been words said. David Cameron said some words, Biden, I think, and others said some words about this. But it strikes me that those, even if we were in the slightest way inclined to believe anything that comes out of their mouths at any time, it strikes me that it's quite a coincidence that Israel is attacking Iran in this way when we've known for, 20 years now that Iran is on the target list of regime change nations.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are claims in Israeli media that Zahedi was involved in the development of nuclear arms or nuclear capability in Iran, which, as far as I'm aware, I've read through many of his autobiographies. I haven't seen any evidence of that fact. But yes, I mean, you know, what they're trying to do effectively is to expand the war beyond Gaza and West Bank. They've been speaking about invading Lebanon. But it also comes on the heels of the revelations about the atrocities that were committed after the IOF basically evacuated the siege of Al-Shifa Hospital. So it could be a number of reasons that they carried out this attack at this time.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Vanessa. Okay, let's come back to the UK. Charles, and the question of food security.
Thanks, Mike, and good afternoon all. Yes, food security was something that we looked at last week, and I wanted to start with a clarification because I made a comparison between the UK and Russia in terms of the land it used for arable farming, but I didn't state explicitly that it was an arable comparison. So just a reminder that the slide on screen now shows 6.1 million hectares of what's called croppable area in the UK and 84.5 million in Russia, meaning that Russia uses nearly 6.5 times as much for the production of food via arable means. But obviously, it wasn't intended as a direct like-for-like comparison. But the point of it was to illustrate that Russia, the butt of constant criticism, was in fact doing something markedly different from the UK. However, since that report, the Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board have rerun their early bird survey, which seems to be associated with the terrible weather that's been experienced in the UK over the last few months, the extreme wet. But this is obviously combined with what I was talking about last week, which is the reduction in land given to the production of food. And the red arrow here shows that arable fallow has increased by 79%. So that's a 79% increase in the amount of land that's being left and is not producing food. Now, it's not clear whether or not that's been inspired particularly by the environmental land management announcements that Steve Barclay made back in January. But nonetheless, it's a very interesting and somewhat alarming correlation. I also spoke about solar farms and the land that's given over to them. And this government document, recently updated in February, talks about the incredible inconsistencies in the planning for solar farms, which states that there are no hard and fast rules about how suitable areas for renewable energy developments should be identified. So we have a situation in which farmers are being paid subsidy simultaneously to produce and not produce food. At the same time, the government's not even able to calculate how much land is used for solar farms and how much of different types of land are used. Now, this is pertinent for several reasons, but not least because of the sort of blanket coverage that the land management schemes give to land that can go into one of these schemes, not really giving much consideration to the type of land itself. But just on the scale of it, the government calculates that approximately 4 acres is needed for each megawatt of output. The government has an intent to produce 70 gigawatts of solar power by the year 2035, which would require just over 113,000 hectares. Now, the Campaign for the Protection of Rural England, Preservation of Rural England, CPRE, put a statement out in February 2022, effectively criticising the government's actions on this. And they specifically make reference to the enormous space on the roofs of commercial buildings, saying that the location of choice for solar developments has become valuable farmland, ignoring the 250,000 hectares of south-facing commercial roof space. Now, very obviously, they're rudimentary figures, but it's perfectly clear that if such an approach were taken, if the government insists on putting solar farms up in the first place, the problem could be dealt with almost immediately by using roof space rather than any farmland at all. What I would encourage you to do is to listen to Steve Gorham talking about this in an interview with Mike a few months ago, The Race to Zero with Steve Gorham, in which he talks about the density by which energy is produced going through all the various natures, and he makes it make a huge amount of sense. So I would encourage you to have a listen to that at this time where we're constantly being told that this is absolutely necessary. But to further highlight the contradictions and the way that land is used, I'm just going to show you written evidence by Solar Energy UK. And now what they talk about is the government's intent to reclassify the definition of best and most versatile BMV land to include grade 3B. Now, I don't need to go into specific detail exactly, but effectively what the government's saying is that they want to deter developers from putting solar panels onto land that is qualified as or classified as being the best for food production. And we're in this absurd situation now where there's effectively competition for sort of net zero method. So on the one hand, you've got farmers wanting to take up government schemes for reed beds and flower meadows and the like. And then on the other side, the solar energy, the solar energy industry wanting to do the same thing and insist that they're going to reach the net zero target, if we can just put that slide back on screen, and deliver tangential benefits such as reduced energy bills and opportunities to increase biodiversity. Of course, they don't exactly explain how that's going to be possible. But just to finish off, we'll look at the way in which all of this affects the taxpayer. Yesterday, the government announced that the British Industry Supercharger will give a huge boost to UK businesses. And effectively, this is subsidising the cost of electricity for certain industries. Now, the critical bit of text is highlighted here because it says that it will fully exempt eligible firms from certain costs linked to renewable energy policies. So the taxpayer is being asked to foot the bill, not just for all the farming subsidies to both produce and not produce food, but also for nature recovery, also for all of the renewable energy technologies that are being introduced. And we see here that since 2013, there's been more than £2.5 billion put into just this particular aspect of the production of renewable energy. So this is going to be something that we'll continue to follow up with a special regard to the use of land.
Now, the issue of what to do with our elderly people, I mean, the answer is obvious. We need to kill them as quickly as possible. But that issue has been getting some headlines over the last couple of days because of an article that we'll talk about in a second, written by Matthew Paris. But I just wanted to start off with this from the BBC this morning. China's aging population, a demographic crisis is unfolding for Xi Jinping. And of course, the narrative here is that there are so many old people in China that they're going to have a major problem with what to do with them. At the same time, we're getting headlines like this. Population tipping point could arrive by 2030. And what this article from Science is saying is that they're highlighting a study which is showing that global fertility levels have reached such that we cannot replace our populations. And so population is going to fall globally over the next period of time. Now, this, of course, is increasingly a problem for the UK as well, as with an ageing population, people being discouraged from having children. The cost of having children is beyond what most people can bear. So, and the government is not providing any support. So, of course, we're going to be dealing with the issue of what to do with our elderly in the not too distant future. So not to miss an opportunity, Matthew Paris decided to publish this article in the Times a few days ago. We can't afford a taboo on assisted dying. So let's have a look and see what he was saying. He said, I can't dispute the objector's belief that once assisted dying becomes normalised, we'll become more apt to ask yourselves how much longer we can justify the struggle. That's the struggle for life. So in other words, you know, do we really want to continue to be a burden on the young and so on? We're really useless eaters. We don't really contribute anything to society. So maybe it's just best to pop off. He goes on, if we just put that. So is life still giving us more pleasure than pain? How much is all this costing relatives in the health service? How much of a burden are we placing on those who love us? How much of a burden are we placing on ourselves? He said, if assisted dying becomes common and widely accepted, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, will consider choosing this road when the time comes, and in some cases ask themselves whether it would be selfish not to. And he went on, within a decade or more, assisted suicide will be seen as a normal road for many to take, to be considered socially responsible, and even finally urged upon people. So this is the narrative that Matthew Paris is pushing. But this isn't the first time he's pushed this narrative in The Spectator. This is published on the 31st of March, 2024. But actually, this is a republication of an article he published some time ago, a number of years ago. Euthanasia is coming, like it or not. If the law does not lead, it will follow. The root reason is Darwinian. So he's implying survival of the fittest is the issue here. So at root, the reason for assisted dying is Darwinian, he said. Tribes that handicap themselves will not prosper. As medical science advances, the cost of prolonging human life way past usefulness will impose an ever heavier burden on the community for an ever longer proportion of its members' lives. And in this article, he went on to say, we may not be aware that our moral attitudes are being driven by the Darwinian struggle for survival, but in part they will be. I don't need to shout from the rooftops that suicide can be a fine and noble thing, or rail against the ever-growing cost of medical care in the final prolonged phase of people's lives. My opinions and my voice are incidental. This is a social impulse which will grow, nourished by forces larger than all of us. Now, of course, there's quite a lot going on in the world which is pushing us in the direction of supporting assisted suicide for the elderly, not least the immigration narrative. But I just wanted to briefly look at where this type of thinking comes from. And I'm going to bring H.G. Wells on screen at this point, because he, of course, known as writing War of the Worlds and many other science fiction books, but he's also a eugenicist and a globalist of the one world government type. The method that must in some cases still be called in is death, the merciful obliteration of weak and silly and pointless things. He said, future humans will naturally regard the modest suicide of the incurably melancholy or diseased or helpless persons as a high and courageous act of duty rather than a crime. And it just strikes me that the type of thinking that Matthew Paris is expressing in his articles is very similar to the type of thinking that Wells expressed at the time. Now, Wells was part of a cabal, including the likes of Bertrand Russell and Julian Huxley and people like this, who were very much involved in creating the United Nations, for example. But if we just look at one particular book by Wells here, The Open Conspiracy, and look at the types of things that he was talking in that book. So he was calling for the end of the nation state forever, to control human population, to eliminate the idea that man is created in the image of God. And I'd completely forgotten this bit, but he was calling for that, or he was making the point that Russia is a crucial target for incorporation into the European system. And it's just incredible when we look back at, or when we look at where the types of policies that we're seeing coming out at the moment, where did they originate? They originate here in this country. So Vanessa, I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that, but the whole issue of assisted dying is a horrendous narrative that's being built.
Yeah, well, if you remember, I covered it fairly extensively for UK Column regarding what was coming through in Canada. But it seems now that Canada is actually backpedaling and the UK is picking up the baton to go forward with the policy. But I don't really have any words to describe it. It's very, very dark and sinister.
Yes. Now, Alexander in the chat box is saying, and Fabian George Bernard Shaw, absolutely part and parcel of this. We shouldn't forget that H.G. Wells was a founder of the Fabian Society. So the Fabian type of thinking is expressed in everything that he did. But anyway, let's move on. If you like what the UK Column does, you'd like to support us, all the options are on support.ukcolumn.org. We can't do what we do without your help. So if you can possibly help us financially, that would be really appreciated. You can pick something up at the UK Column shop, but please do find share anything you find on the various platforms, especially ukcolumn.org and ukcolumnextracts.co.uk. Now, yesterday at 1 o'clock, we had an interview with Hilary Baltrop on her mother, Lois, who was killed in the NHS system. And she was asking, could she have done more? She and her mother were UK Column members. If you haven't seen that, please do have a look at it. It's on the website, and share it as widely as possible. And Charles, tomorrow you are speaking to Sir Julian Rose.
That's right. Julian Rose will be a familiar name to UK Column audiences. And he spoke about his introduction to organic farming back in the 1970s, how there was no market for it, but still he made it work through the proximity principle, essentially growing food on a small scale to satisfy a local market. And then he talks me through how corrupted that system has become up until the present day, sort of leading off into things such as transhumanism and the rest of it. So it's a very interesting insight into a long, long career in organic farming at the business end of it.
So that's at 1 p.m. tomorrow, ukcolumn.org/live and the usual places. A reminder of the Stand in the Light Festival taking place in May. in Cumbria. The details on screen at the moment and will be in the show notes. And also for Sounds Beautiful Festival taking place in Dorset on June the 27th to the 30th. We will either all or some of us will be at both of those events. So do join us, come along to those if you possibly can. Now, let's move on to NATO. And of course, some people suggest that NATO is quite Nazi-like in its being. I couldn't possibly suggest such a thing. But of course, this is the 75th anniversary of NATO this year. Well, in order to celebrate that, all the foreign ministers are getting together with Jens Stoltenberg in Brussels today and tomorrow. Well, let's just have a look at a couple of words from Jens Stoltenberg.
Foreign ministers will meet today and tomorrow to mark NATO's 75th anniversary and to prepare for our summit in Washington in July. NATO was founded on the single solemn promise: an attack on one ally is an attack on all. From that foundation, we have built the most powerful and successful alliance in history. And over the past 75 years, NATO's open door has helped to spread democracy and prosperity across Europe. As we celebrate NATO's achievements, we do not rest upon them. Europe now faces war on a scale we thought was resigned to history. We must ensure reliable and predictable security assistance to Ukraine for the long haul, so that we rely less on voluntary contributions and more on NATO commitments, less on short-term offers and more on multi-year pledges. Therefore, ministers will discuss how NATO could assume more responsibility for coordinating military equipment and training for Ukraine, anchoring this within a robust NATO framework.
So hopefully that didn't make you vomit too much, but Charles, this is quite an incredible situation. We're looking at a war, the type of war that we couldn't envisage, he says, and we've got to stop this voluntary donations of weapons to Ukraine and actually formalize it within the NATO structures. This is taking us a massive step closer to direct conflict with Russia.
It is. And a particular note that he describes NATO's open door, but apparently not the sort of door in the shape of Russia, who, of course, asked to join NATO and were told that actually they couldn't after all. So, yes, very, very strange speech.
Yes, under this present regime, of course, because we saw from H.G. Wells just a few minutes ago, Russia is to be assimilated. But anyway, David Cameron, of course, is there. So let's bring him on screen. He's saying 75 years after its creation, we are celebrating a NATO that's never been stronger or more important, especially following Sweden's accession last month. Allies need to step up and spend more on defence in the face of continued Russian aggression and a more dangerous world. Well, it's all a bit unfortunate because actually Moody's, the ratings agency, has come out with a report basically making the point that if people do start spending more in the types of ways that are being described by Stoltenberg and Cameron there, that the debt burden on nations is beyond what they can bear. I'm not quite sure how this is going to work on a long-term basis. They want to sustain the conflict in Ukraine for as long as possible. Are they going to keep it at a low level, just killing as many people as possible, but not using very much armaments themselves? Or are they going to try to ramp it up? Either way, they can't afford to do it. And we don't have the productive capability anyway. Vanessa, I don't know if you've got thoughts on this, but the rhetoric that comes out of these people, and I note, by the way, that Mr. Rutte from the Netherlands is no longer tipped to replace Jens Stoltenberg. It's now the Estonian prime minister. They can't actually find anybody that's going to be competent, but they still keep making the threats.
I don't know. I just find it extraordinary. I mean, do they actually believe what they're saying? I mean, does this democracy, peace and democracy and freedom nonsense still wash while they're supporting Israel committing genocide and severely curtailing the freedom of not only Palestinians, but the entire region. I mean, it's just, I don't know, we just seem to be living on two separate, complete,
separated
realities and dimensions right now.
Yeah, incredible. Incredible. Okay, let's come back to the UK then, Charles, and policing.
Policing, indeed. I'll take you back to the aftermath of the 7th of October last year and the interventions from the then Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, which looked very much like they ran roughshod over the notion of operational independence of police, with her taking what looked like a very one-sided approach to responses of protests, demonstrations, and the like all over the United Kingdom. Now, just last week, James Cleverly finally got round to responding to the State of Policing 2022 report, the most significant detail of which was to refer to new powers for His Majesty's Inspector of Constabulary, specifically granting HMIC the power to direct forces, which is a significant new power. Such a power would need a proper system of accountability to accompany it. And then he reminds the inspectorate that he already holds powers under Section 40 of the Police Act 1996 to intervene where a force or local policing body is failing. So whilst that looks clear-cut, it is in fact at the beginnings of lines being very blurred. And I'll go on to explain what I mean by that, because if we look at the Inspectorate of Constabulary Fire and Rescue Services website, which has not been updated because it's not yet clear how these powers will actually take effect. So they state at the moment that they're an inspectorate and not a regulator, and that inspectorates have powers to secure information, but no powers to give orders for change. And they go on to remind us that it's for chief constables, whose operational independence is a cornerstone of British policing, to effectively make decisions about all matters operational, as well as what they do with the recommendations. Now, what's worth going back to is the original report from the inspectorate, which is, as I say, dated 2022. And specifically, their recommendations are that the chief inspector of constabulary should be provided with a power to give directions in relation to a police force in cases where an inspection identifies a failing that poses a significant risk to public safety. So I'd like you to bear that in mind, specifically the reference to public safety. We then see how mission creep can affect itself in the second paragraph, where we talk about limited circumstances being the case in which further power should be provided to give direction to the NPCC. Now, I submitted a Freedom of Information request at the Home Office to ask about meetings between police chiefs and the Home Secretary during the period of COVID restrictions that year. And I was sent, as part of the reply, a letter which was about the COVID enforcement strategy. And you'll see that it's signed not least by Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, but also by Martin Hewitt. So in effect, they had teamed up, and it looks very much like the purpose of doing so was to attempt to get around the issue of operational independence. In that letter, they quite clearly state that this period will undoubtedly be challenging. So with your input, we have jointly developed a COVID-19 police enforcement strategy to meet these challenges and target resources. Now, that sounds to me very much like the Home Office is giving operational direction to police. They go on to say that they agree that police activity should be weighted towards those areas where infection rates are most acute. And they talk about heightened visibility and patrols and priorities placed on areas with highest rates of infection. That is without doubt meddling in the operational affairs of police constables. So we go further into this by looking at the minutes of meetings from the chief constables' meetings back in that period. And in January, before all this nonsense started, they talk about policing having funding for uplift, but it won't be the solution to other challenges such as public safety. But of course, by June of 2020, they're talking about the government being very closely engaged in policing and having a number of demands that they want policing to deliver on. Again, further interference. But of course, because it fell under the banner of COVID, it would appear that anything went. By July, we see that it's actually a two-way street, and the chiefs discussed new legislation being implemented. This is about wearing face coverings. And they requested more engagement with government to reinforce viewpoints on the right level of intervention. So the direction that this could go in is very alarming. And particularly, I take you back to what was said about public safety, because that's really at the heart of this. And public safety, obviously, in this context, is meant to mean a sort of a health emergency. But of course, it can include censorship, it could include extremism, it could even now include the specter of war. And so just to remind you of exactly how these things can go wrong, we'll look at just go back to the House of Commons Library briefing on enforcing COVID restrictions. And it's always worth noting that lockdown restriction enforcement was an operational matter for the police. This means police leaders, not national or local politicians, decided whether and how to deploy their officers to lockdown enforcement. So it's very clear from that the Home Secretary had absolutely no business meddling in the affairs of the police chiefs, the police forces, any of those bodies to dictate exactly how they should deploy their resources, use their funding, any of those sorts of things. And yet we've seen it happen. So to go back to the possible change whereby the inspector of constabulary is granted new powers to direct police forces with public safety in mind, it sets a very alarming precedent. And Mike, I don't know if you've got any particular thoughts on it, perhaps regarding sort of censorship and extremism, but the direction of travel does not seem to be the right one.
No, and the Inspectorate of Constabulary is there to assess the role that the police are playing, and are they fulfilling their obligations? Once we start getting politicians telling them what they're supposed to be enforcing, Absolutely. That becomes extremely dangerous. And we see this as being another regulatory regime being built alongside Ofcom, MHRA, yep, and a whole bunch of other regulators that are not there, in fact, for public safety. It's for the safety of the government, as far as I can see. But anyway, let's move back to the Middle East. And Vanessa, let's look at the aid convoy incident, if we can call it an incident.
Yeah, sort of an interesting incident. This is a report in Al Mayadeen from yesterday. So this happened at pretty much the same time as Israel carried out the attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus. The headline here, Israel claims that the World Central Kitchen, the WCK workers, killed in error after bombing them three times. And if we look at the kind of satellite imagery that Al Mayadeen has included in their article, you can see that actually it was three fairly, one assumes, precision strikes on the coastal area targeting the various cars of these aid workers inside Gaza. Now, in the Mayadeen article, they point out the reaction from the UK Foreign Ministry, which summoned the Israeli ambassador. However, they didn't summon the Israeli ambassador to discuss the targeting of 100,000 plus Palestinians in Gaza, nor of the bombing of the embassy in Damascus. However, they summoned the ambassador to discuss this and to express the government's unequivocal condemnation of the crime. France and Canada condemned the attack. Australia also summoned the Israeli ambassador to Canberra over the crime. All of these nations, by the way, have been silent over the Israeli bombing in Damascus. The US, meanwhile, just stuck with offering its condolences. And let's have a quick look at the statement by John Kirby.
Your question presumes, at this very early hour, that it was a deliberate strike, that they knew exactly what they were hitting, that they were hitting aid workers and did it on purpose, and there's no evidence of that. I would also remind you, sir, that we continue to look at incidents as they occur. The State Department has a process in place. And to date, as you and I are speaking, they have not found any incidents where the Israelis have violated international humanitarian law. And lest you think we don't take it seriously, I can assure you that we do. We look at this in real time.
They have never violated international humanitarian law ever in the past 5 to 6 months.
I'm telling you, the State Department has looked at incidents in the past and has yet to determine that any of those incidents violate international humanitarian law.
I mean, just, I don't really know what to say at that, but the U.S. denial of the atrocities committed by Israel is becoming quite obscene, actually. Now, what's interesting, let's have a look at these World Central Kitchen so-called aid workers. Now, the three British, I didn't manage to create a slide because I only found this out just before I came on. Three of the British that were killed were former SAS, now working for a private security company called Solace Global. But at the same time, Grey Zone did an investigation a little while back on the 27th of March into the chef that is basically the CEO of the organization. So let's have a look at what they say. People can obviously read the article for themselves. There's a lot of detail in it. So after years of accusing Russia of using food as a weapon in its conflict with Ukraine, State Department culinary ambassador Jose Andres is working with the Israeli government to supplant UNRWA as the main supplier of aid to northern Gaza. The operation appears designed to, as a stopgap measure, to provide minimal quantities of food to Gaza's famine-stricken population until the U.S. military finishes building a pier in the Mediterranean Sea and a shadowy contractor run by former U.S. Marines and CIO officials is able to implement an aid program called the Blue Beach Plan. So his organization, the World Central Kitchen, has already finished constructing its own jetty, which was made from rubble heaps in Gaza, a decision that virtually guaranteed the building materials contain the remains of humans killed by the Israeli bombing. So it has to raise questions over who these people really were. Were they killed? Were by Israel. Now, one of the fallouts from this event is that the ships that are bringing aid from Cyprus to the U.S. Pier in Gaza are turning back. One has already turned back with 240 tons of undelivered aid. And then if we look at what the officials are actually saying, Cyprus Foreign Minister said on Tuesday that undelivered food and supplies were being returned after aid groups suspended operations due to the brutal killing of members of an international charity. Whose hands does this play into? Into Israel's, that is deliberately starving the 1.2 million Palestinians inside Gaza, shutting down UNRWA, closing all entrances into Gaza, set up the pier. Now suddenly that's falling apart because of the killing of the humanitarian aid workers. It seems very convenient for me.
Yes. I don't really know what else to say. And I mean, you know, John Kirby, I have to admit to laughing. And yeah. we shouldn't be laughing at this, because actually it's despicable. But it's so despicable, it's really hard not to react in that way.
It's like a parody. I mean, it's just extraordinary.
Yes. Thanks, Vanessa. Okay, Charles, let's come up to date with CBDC.
Yes, thank you, Mike. And in particular, we'll start actually with the forecast, the precious metals forecast by the London Bullion Market Association for this year. Worth looking at because of particularly what's been happening with gold, but significantly they cite the top three drivers for the gold price this year as being US monetary policy, central bank activity, and geopolitical risks. And I think the question that falls out of that is how separate are those three things? But the World Gold Council has simultaneously, 28th March, published, or rather updated its document, Gold as a Strategic Asset, the 2024 edition. And this is where we see the process of nudge that I was speaking about last year continue to affect itself. We talk about the ESG credentials and contributions, and specifically they say that gold has a potential role to play in reducing investor exposure to climate-related risks. In fact, gold's lack of downstream emissions has important implications, as gold holdings can reduce the overall carbon intensity of the portfolio value. Anyway, they go on in this vein. Now, why would they be talking about this? Well, It seems likely that the reason is to further nudge people into the position of considering not so much physical gold, which has reached a record high price shown on screen now, 1970 being on the left-hand side of the graph, up to 2024, but the move away from physical gold to digital gold, which you may remember I reported on late last year as being something that might potentially back a central bank digital currency. The other part of that report was to do with the consultation into CBDC, or particularly the digital pound run by the Bank of England and the Treasury. They have produced a response, admittedly, a couple of months ago, but I thought I would share some of the results of it with you. In effect, I should remind you that this is still, as the House of Lords put it, a solution in search of a problem. In effect, they've been completely unable to justify why a digital pound is necessary. In the last sentence here, whichever way you choose to pay, you can always trust the value of the money you're spending or receiving. A £10 note in your hand will always be worth £10 in your bank account. So in effect, they're sort of shooting themselves in the foot at the same time as trying to sell the thing. But what I thought was, of the 50,000 plus responses, there was a recurring theme from it. And I'll just read a few quotes. The majority of responses commented on the broader societal implications of introducing retail CBDC, such as the future of cash and the privacy and rights of users of a digital pound. They go on again. Others raise concerns about important issues such as the potential impact on privacy, access to cash and freedom of choice. So again, the same thing coming up, but later on. Many respondents raise concerns about the implication of such a digital pound for access to cash, users' privacy, and control of their money. So what this indicates really is that of the 50,000 respondents, which is a good total, I would say, by any account, it means that people's messages really couldn't have been sort of effectively buried by the Bank of England or the Treasury because they were so numerous. Anyway, they go on. And again, to sort of open themselves up to the fundamental failings, the bank, as an operator of the core infrastructure, would not have access to personal data. Private sector digital pound wallet providers, payment interface providers, PIPs, would anonymize personal data before transactions are processed and settled by the bank. The bank and HM Treasury would also not pursue government or central bank initiated programmable functions. So they're working very hard here to allay concerns about privacy, about technical failures and programming and all that sort of thing. But I would say that they are failing because they're not actually addressing the fundamental issue of handing control of part of the process over to a third party over which they have absolutely no control. They don't know where that data is going to go. They don't know that those technical platforms are going to be up to whatever it is they're going to manage them. And that is giving the Treasury and the Bank of England the benefit of the doubt in the first place and suggesting that they will be able to do a better job of it at all. So still in no way convincing whatsoever. But in conclusion, what they state is that the decision as to whether to build a digital pound will be made around the middle of the decade at the earliest, as the design phase draws to a close. That decision will draw on extensive engagement with stakeholders across all of society. Well, I wonder how that's going to affect itself. Throughout the design phase, as part of the development of the digital pound's blueprint, the national conversation on the future of money and the parliamentary scrutiny of the bank and HM Treasury's design work. So to summarise what they've said in this response, it does, I would say, look very much like they have rode back on their initial bravado, which they sort of seem to lay the case out for CBDC with. So it does suggest that at least at this point, the responses that have been received from the 50,000 or so that came in have really stopped and made them think. And I think that's, you know, that's gone hand in hand with what the House of Lords have done with some committee hearings in the Houses of Parliament. So the tide has the potential to at least be stemmed, if not change direction. However, what I would issue as a note of caution is that they are, again, continuing to suggest, or at least lay the groundwork for there being some sort of a seismic change. And having listened to what Mike is talking about earlier with the potential bankruptcy of nations by continuing NATO activities, it would be that sort of activity that would allow or would set the conditions for the abolition of cash and the total restructuring of the financial system. So this is definitely not going away, but what they are yet to find is a very well articulated argument for justifying it. But this is something that they will continue to pursue.
Yes, indeed. Okay, let's move on to online safety. And of course, we have this situation of them wanting to ban chat. Well, of course, they don't really want to ban chat as such. They just want to ban encrypted chat. So they want to be able to see what we're all talking about. And if you remember last year when we were talking about this, we mentioned the open letter from security and privacy researchers in relation to the Online Safety Bill, as it was at that time. It's now the Online Safety Act. But they said at the time, this was various organizations that provide chat functionality, including Signal and WhatsApp and the Telegram and people like this. In this letter, we wish to highlight alarming misunderstandings and misconceptions around the Online Safety Bill and its interaction with privacy and security technologies that our daily online transactions and communication rely on. And they were highlighting the dangers of what was being proposed at the time. Now, of course, the organization who is responsible for actually creating the regime that we will be living under the Online Safety Act is Ofcom. They have this document here: tech firms must clamp down on illegal online materials. And of course, they are saying that children are the key priority. And at the very bottom of this document, it says the proposal will only apply to public communications where it's technically feasible for a service to use this technology. Consistent and with the restrictions in the Act, they do not apply to private communications or end-to-end encrypted communications. However, end-to-end encrypted services are still subject to all the safety duties set out in the Act and will still need to take steps to mitigate risks of child sexual abuse material on their service. So CSAM being used as the excuse to pursue the agenda of making sure that anybody can snoop on people's private communications as widely as possible. We see the same thing happening in the European Union. So this is the Council of the European Union and their document on this topic, which was published in March. This is basically talking about pretty much exactly the same types of things. So let's bring a quote. In the light of the more limited risk of their use for the purposes of child sexual abuse and the need to preserve confidential information, including classified information, information covered by professional secrecy and trade secrets, electronic communication services that are not publicly available, such as those for national security purposes, should be excluded from the scope of this regulation. So the EU absolutely using the child sexual abuse narrative to justify the removal of, or at least the ability to get round end-to-end encryption so that they can snoop on people's communications. That will apply if you're using WhatsApp or Signal or whatever. But if you're an intelligence agency or a government department, or if you're a corporation that's using a communications technology which isn't available to the public but is only available to your employees, that would not be within scope of this. So, excuse me. So I'm just going to ask the question, would it be appropriate in the UK if we follow this suggestion, for example, or this applies in the European Union as well, of course, would it be appropriate to allow MPs if we're all obliged to be clear and in the open with our communications? Is there a lesser risk with MPs with respect to child sexual abuse material? Or is there a lesser risk with intelligence agencies? Because this article in Declassified UK is all about Kinkora in Northern Ireland, where MI5 for a number of decades was quite happy for the abuse of young boys to take place. Excuse me. So, I do apologise.
This is Declassified talking about the cover-up by MI5, the British government seeking to prevent a full inquiry into horrific boys' abuse of boys' home in Belfast. But, of course, that's promoting their intelligence agenda.
Thank you for bailing me out there, Charles. Well, anyway, the point is, if we're going to have end-to-end encryption subverted in this way, it seems to me, in order to protect children, governments and intelligence agencies are the first organizations that should be transmitting their materials in the clear. Anyway, we can talk a bit more about that in extra. Vanessa, let's come back to you and the Observer here, and what is going on with Israel and international law?
Well, I thought this was interesting that this story was leaked over the Easter weekend when potentially people's attention might not be fully on this kind of information. So UK government lawyers say that Israel is breaking international law, claims top Tory in leaked recording. So the chair of Foreign Affairs Select Committee, Alicia Kern, said at a Tory fundraiser that legal advice would mean the UK has to cease all arms sales to Israel without delay. So let's actually see what she said. So she was at an evening drinks reception hosted by the West Hampstead and Fortune Green Conservatives in London. She said the Foreign Office has received official legal advice that Israel has broken international humanitarian law, but the government has not announced it. They have said, they have not said it. They haven't stopped arms exports. They have done a very few small sanctions on Israeli settlers, and everyone internationally has agreed that settlers are illegal. We made that point, Mike, that this was all kind of smoke and mirrors by various EU and by the British government. She told the gathering that both she and Cameron believe strongly in Israel's right to defend itself, but the right to self-defense has a limit in law. It's not limitless. And she went on to suggest that Israel's actions put its and the UK's long-term security at risk. Some of the ways in which Israel is prosecuting this is making their long-term security less certain. It is making our, the UK's, long-term security less certain. I'm amazed that our national threat level has not gone up. So on the question of British government transparency and accountability, this is just another nail in that coffin.
Yes, indeed it is. Now, I just want to end with this. So the Daily Mail pushing this out, and I'm just staggered that this continues to hint that we're heading back towards, they're going to try this game again. So the tweet here says, it's a matter of when, not if. So dailymail.com asks 7 bird flu experts if the H5N1 case in Texas raises risks of a future pandemic. And this is what they said. Now, I'm not going to go into what they said in the article. Everybody can imagine what they said in the article. But of course, this story is about the herd of cattle in Texas that has apparently been cross-contaminated with bird flu. And of course, this means that we're all going to die. So we've got to, first of all, kill all our cattle. And second of all, be prepared for further lockdowns and vaccination regimes. What more can we say?
Yeah, exactly. And apparently animal welfare is at the centre of it, specifically where it concerns birds. The idea that locking them up inside would be a better alternative is extraordinary. And of course, we know it doesn't work because we tried it with humans and it went disastrously wrong.
Oh, but we don't need to worry because we've got the new gene editing legislation, which means we can genetically engineer chickens that don't mind being indoors all the time. Right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Now we've got a special guest joining us for Extra, but tell us about this.
I will. You may remember, if you were tuned in to what's been going on in Gloucestershire, that Matthew Randolph has been sticking it to Gloucester City Council, specifically to do with the way in which they have tried to roll out 5G masts since 2020. An article here from Gloucestershire Live about a meeting that he attended, as well as some police. And just a few points from Matthew, who, as Mike says, will be joining us for Extra. So I really would encourage you to stay on and listen to him. But particularly, he has unearthed that the Freedom of Information request showed that there were 30 prior approval applications for 5G masks since 2020 that had been approved, but there was no evidence of any meaningful public consultation in accordance with planning law, and also the invalid ICNIRP certificates of safety submitted, which constitutes a breach of planning policy because it was made under the name of a company called 3 UK Limited, which was dissolved in 2015. So that's just a snapshot. Matthew will be going into much greater detail as to exactly how he's achieved this, but he's really caused enormous changes at the council. And the other detail that's fallen out of this, which I definitely should make you aware of, lest it be a course of action that somebody else might be considering, he has put himself forward as an independent police and crime commissioner, and he's raised the £5,000 some required. So I think we're going to have a very interesting session in Extra. If you're unable to join us in Extra, then I can point you towards the indomitable Rachel Matthews' recent interview with Matthew and Johnny Mack at Colchester Council Watch on YouTube. He gives a very good account of exactly how things have transpired and what further actions he's going to be taken. So I hope we'll see you a bit later.
Okay, well, that's it for today. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to Vanessa and to Charles for taking part. And we will be back, as we say, for Extra in a couple of minutes' time if you're a UK Column member. Otherwise, don't forget the interview with Julian Rose at 1 p.m. tomorrow. And we'll be back on Friday at 1 p.m. as usual for the news. See you then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.